Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. We come to you 7 days a week to help you learn and improve your American English. Today, we begin with a serious subject. The United Nations has issued a report about civilian deaths in Afghanistan. We will have details. Then, something more enjoyable. Some young people in the Democratic Republic of Congo are using music as they call for peace instead of violence. As It is coming to you right now. The United Nations says conflict-related deaths and injuries among Afghan civilians rose last year. The UN says the number of civilian deaths and injuries was 22% higher than in 2013. UN officials are blaming the Taliban and other rebel groups for most of the casualties. Officials say the higher numbers are a result of ground fighting between opposing sides in the Afghan conflict. Bob Doty has more.
The UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan released a report on civilian casualties in Afghanistan. It says the number of deaths and injuries last year was the highest in a single year since 2009. Georgette Gagnon is director of human rights for the UN mission. She says intensified ground fighting between Afghan government forces and the rebels has produced the rise in casualties. She says the rebels have used weapons such as rockets, shells, and grenades in and around population centers. She says the withdrawal of international forces and air support led to the increased fighting.
The UN documented 10,548 civilian casualties in 2014. Civilian casualties from ground operations surged, making them the leading cause of civilian casualties and the biggest killers of Afghan women and children in 2014.
Georgette Gagnon says the UN report linked the Taliban and other Afghan government opponents to 72% of all civilian deaths. The report said the Afghan armed forces were linked to 14% of all deaths, and international forces to 2%. UN researchers could not identify which side was responsible for the rest of the deaths. The human rights director says the second leading cause of civilian casualties was improvised explosive devices, commonly known as IEDs. Militants often used IEDs to attack Afghan or international forces. The report also noted increased numbers of suicide attacks last year. Ms. Gagnon spoke to reporters in Kabul. She read a message from the UN's human rights chief. The message said the attacks on Afghan civilians were unacceptable and could be considered war crimes. The statement called on all sides to respect international agreements.
Documenting these trends should not be regarded as a body count, but as a vital step towards accountability. It is high time that states live up to their responsibility to protect civilians, and that perpetrators of war crimes and other violations understand that they will face justice for what they have done.
Nicholas Haysom heads the UN office in Kabul. He urged the Taliban to honor their public statements to avoid civilian casualties and stop attacking civilians.
They have accepted in their engagements with us that protection of civilians is important and have pledged to take certain measures to eradicate civilian casualties from their own part. We have gratifyingly seen public commitments. Now is the time for results.
The Taliban has strongly rejected earlier UN findings that blamed the group for the majority of civilian deaths in Afghanistan. The Taliban accuses the United Nations of using only information provided by its enemies. I'm Bob Doty.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America. A few years ago, a youth group set out to organize a music festival for peace in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The young people were tired of years of violence in the eastern DRC. They decided to hold the event in the eastern city of Goma. Their first attempt in 2013 was canceled because Goma came under attack. But last year, 25,000 people came to the city to hear their favorite Congolese artists play. And this year, some of Africa's top musicians decided to attend. Jonathan Evans has more.
The crowd cheered when Habib Koyate arrived for his performance. The smoke machines fired up. Some people stood one behind another, forming a conga line. Thousands of other people ate, drank, and danced in the dust. Music festivals are popular across Africa. But this is something few would have imagined possible in Goma. For years, the city has been linked to crises. Refugees went there after the Rwandan genocide in 1994. In 2002, a nearby volcano exploded. The explosion buried part of the city under liquid rock. In recent years, competing rebel groups have captured and recaptured Goma. But one youth group believed that their city could be different. They turned to music to make that happen. The Amani Music Festival took place earlier this month. Vianney Bisimwa was one of the organizers. He says he and the other young people wanted to change the image of Goma.
We go through war, and the war was really negatively impacted the promotion of culture. So the idea was, how can we try to change the way people see this town? Because all the report on DRC was, don't go there, people are killed, there is no way, no hope, no future.
Although the country is known for war, it is also famous for its music. Many local artists sing openly about the conflict. Vianney Bisimwa says this gives people a chance to express their feelings.
Music is powerful in DRC. When people are tired, they go to dance. When people are angry, they dance or they sing how they are angry. And people believe in what they understand, in what they hear.
Some local people say life in Goma is already improving. This man says Goma has already changed a lot from the days when the M23 rebel group ruled the city. He says people are hungry for peace. Organizing a show in Goma has not been easy. The first music festival was canceled when M23 rebels controlled the surrounding hills. But the show the following year was a success. Violence returned to the city last month when police opened fire on demonstrators. They were protesting changes in Congo's electoral law. Vianney Bisimwa says it is not always clear that Goma is making progress. tensions lie seemingly just below the surface. But peace, he adds, is a process. He hopes events like this will get people talking about the past and thinking about the future. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Thank you for listening. This is VOA.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. A new law in Arizona requires high school students to pass the United States naturalization test. Immigrants to the United States must pass this test to become a citizen. The test contains 100 questions on U.S. history and government. The Joe Foss Institute, a nonprofit organization in Arizona, worked with legislators to create the law. Their goal is to pass a law in each of the 50 states to require high school students to pass the naturalization test. The new state laws will increase the number of American students who understand how their government works. Few students currently have this knowledge. A 2010 national test showed only about 25% of students in their final year of high school had a good understanding of American democracy. 36% did not even have a basic understanding.
And that's obviously a shame. It's not only a shame, it's dangerous for a democracy to have people in a level of ignorance or apathy or both.
John Hale is the associate director of the nonprofit Center for Civic Education in California. The organization has promoted the ideas and behaviors of democracy for 50 years. Mr. Hale thinks it is dangerous when citizens do not know or care about how their government works. He says students do not only need to learn facts about government, they should also learn how to participate in their local communities. Requiring high school students to take the naturalization test might be a way to improve students' civic behavior, he says.
You know, the adage, if it isn't tested, it isn't taught.
But some wonder if a test young people take in high school will make adults more active in their communities. Sam Stone writes a blog for the Civics Education Initiative. The initiative is part of the Joe Foss Institute, which helped create the Arizona law. Mr. Stone says research shows that civic education does result in more involved adults. He noted a 2012 survey that found the more young people studied civics and current events in high school, the more likely they were to vote and understand politics. Mr. Stone says requiring a civics exam should make schools do more than just prepare for the test.
We hope after they take this first step, that schools and states and school districts, teachers, really look for how they can get their kids involved actively in their communities.
For the VOA Education Report, I'm Jill Robbins.
¶¶ Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. President James Garfield was shot and seriously wounded in the summer of 1881. The man who shot him said he supported the political group that supported Vice President Chester Arthur. The gunman was found to be insane, but some people were ready to believe the worst about Vice President Arthur. They knew that many of the Vice President's political allies disliked President Garfield. They thought the Vice President might have helped the gunman in some way. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell what happened after President Garfield was shot.
For a time, it seemed the president might get better. But the bullet wound became infected. He died of the infection 2 months after he was shot. Vice President Arthur took the oath of office a few hours after the president's death. Chester Arthur had been a successful lawyer. He had worked in politics for a number of years, but he had never before held an elected office. Many Americans questioned his ability to serve in the White House. One person put it this way: Chet Arthur, President of the United States? Good God!
Almost everyone feared Arthur would be a tool of a Republican Party leader in New York, Roscoe Conkling. They were sure Conkling would be the real power in Arthur's administration. They were wrong. Chester Arthur surprised everyone. He broke all his ties with the Conkling political machine. He remained independent of any party group. Arthur asked Garfield's cabinet to resign. He chose new men for all but one department.
In his first message to Congress, President Arthur asked for changes in the way government jobs were filled. He proposed a new civil service system that would let ability, not politics, decide who got government jobs. Republican Party leaders opposed these proposals. The civil service system would stop them from giving federal jobs to their supporters. It would destroy much of their power. These Republican leaders controlled Congress. They refused to act on the civil service proposals.
Civil service reform, however, was an important issue. President Garfield had been assassinated by a man who believed he should have gotten a government job because of his politics. Also, new cases of dishonesty had been discovered in the post office department. The public began to demand laws to clean up the civil service. In 1882, a new Congress was elected. The new Congress was controlled by the Democratic Party. President Arthur again appealed for civil service reform. This time, he got results. The new Congress passed a civil service bill that required 10% of all federal jobs to be filled through competitive examinations. This 10% included half the officials in the post office department. It included most workers at federal customs houses. The bill also said it was illegal for politicians to ask government employees for campaign money, and it set up a civil service committee to enforce the new law.
President Arthur also found himself faced with an unusual problem. The government was earning more money than it needed. Most of the money came from tariffs, taxes on imports. Each year, tariffs brought in $100 million more than the government needed. The import taxes had been set high to protect American industries from foreign competition. President Arthur wanted to reduce the tariffs. Congress wanted to keep them high. Industrial leaders wanted to keep them high, too. They did not want to compete with low-priced foreign products.
Congress saw no problem with the extra money brought in by high tariffs. It found many ways to spend it. For example, Congress raised payments to soldiers who had fought in the Civil War during the 1860s. It also approved money to build roads, bridges, and waterways throughout the country. Many of these things were not needed. They were approved for political purposes. They put government money into the home areas of powerful congressmen. In 1882, Congress passed the Rivers and Harbors Bill. The bill would cost almost $19 million. President Arthur vetoed the bill. He said it would waste too much money, but Congress passed the bill into law over his veto.
Next, President Arthur urged Congress to form a committee to find a way to reduce tariffs. Congress formed the committee. The committee proposed that tariffs be reduced by 20%. But Congress did not consider the proposal when it began debating a new tariff bill. President Arthur was more successful in getting Congress to reduce the public debt. During his term, the debt was cut by more than $400 million.
Chester Arthur's efforts for honest government and lower taxes won him much support among the people, but he could not win the support of his Republican Party. Arthur wanted to serve another 4 years in the White House. His name was put before the Republican nominating convention in 1884. The name of Senator James Blaine of Maine also was put before the convention. On the first ballot, Blaine received 334 votes. Arthur got only 278. 3 ballots later, Blaine won the presidential nomination. However, many Republicans refused to support Blaine. They accused him of being dishonest. They said he was controlled by powerful politicians.
The Democratic Party chose New York Governor Grover Cleveland as its presidential candidate. Like Chester Arthur at the national level, Grover Cleveland was known for fighting dishonesty in government at the local level. He began as mayor of the city of Buffalo, New York. He cleaned up the city government and saved the taxpayers much money. Next, he was elected governor of New York State. There, too, he helped end dishonesty in government. Cleveland refused to give jobs to Democrats because of their political ties. Instead, he filled state jobs with men of ability. This early success helped him win the Democratic presidential nomination.
The campaign of 1884 between Republican Blaine and Democrat Cleveland was one of the most bitter in American political history. A group of Republicans who opposed Blaine published letters to prove he was dishonest. Blaine had written the letters several years earlier during a shameful incident concerning the sale of railroad stock. Now he was forced to defend himself against those old charges.
Blaine's supporters fought back by discovering a scandal in Cleveland's past. Grover Cleveland had never married, but more than 10 years earlier, he had been involved with a young woman. The woman gave birth to a boy. Cleveland was not sure the boy was his son, but he accepted responsibility for the child. He sent money to help care for him. A Republican newspaper published the story. Soon, Republican crowds were shouting a joke about it. "Ma, Ma, where's my pa?" "Gone to the White House. Ha, ha, ha."
Both candidates campaigned hard. It was clear to everyone that the vote would be close. Election day was cold and rainy. Early results showed the two candidates with almost the same number of electoral votes. The winner would be the one who captured a majority of the popular votes in New York State. That candidate would then get all of New York's electoral votes. It was not until 3 days after the voting that election officials announced Cleveland had won. His victory set off wild celebrations among Democrats across the country. Grover Cleveland really was going to the White House. Ha, ha, ha. His election would bring some important changes to the country. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The names were Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs are online, along with historical images at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.